Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
So we're going to leave all that rancour of the previous hour behind now. My next guest today is Noel McCarthy from Cork. Hi, Noel.
Good morning, Brendan.
And you've written a memoir called Grand, and it's been a huge hit in New Zealand where you live now. It's about you and drink, and it's also kind of a love letter to your mother, Carl. You and your mother, it would be fair to say, drove each other mad.
That's a very succinct summation of the relationship, definitely, yes.
Yeah, yeah. She was a complex individual. And look, I think we come to the explanation of her and the kind of the redemption of the two of you later on, maybe. But just on Carl first, one way you look at her was that she was, you say, a werewolf. One drop of drink and she changed.
Yeah. Yeah, that image came to me very early on in the process of writing about her. And partly it was something that was given to me by her. She had a horror of werewolves. She was also sort of obsessed with them.
Yeah.
And An American Werewolf in London was one of her favourite films to be horrified by. And I'd cut out a photo of the transformation scene in that film from my Empire magazine. And I used to sort of wait around corners and jump out at her with it. And she'd say, take that away, don't show me that. And it's one of the happy memories I have of us and of our relationship. And later on, when I was thinking back about us and about our life together, I thought about that, and I thought about this sort of that mixture of horror and fascination and delight, which sort of led me into thinking about her as a mythical, terrifying creature.
Yeah. And I mean, the drinking, in a way, it was dysfunctional, but not like completely chaotic. She had kind of her nooks and crannies around Cork, basically, didn't she? She was the scourge of barmen. Like, tell us a bit about her kind of routines.
Well, she did, and I don't think she'd have been alone in that. Like, yeah. Cork is a city of nooks and crannies, isn't it? And she wasn't alone in the bars either. And I suppose when I started looking back on that and thinking about that time that she'd spend in the bars, because it was always during the day, of course, you know, because she, at one stage, I mean, she had three children who would have been under five. And these times in the pub for her with her friends, they were stolen times. You know, they were times between getting dropped off to go to Dunn's or wherever she was going and being picked up by the funeral home at 4 o'clock. And it was in those little periods of time in various nooks and crannies around the north side and the inner city that the life would happen, you know, that she'd be able to see her friends and they'd be together. And of course, I was with her because she didn't have anywhere else to bring me.
Okay.
And I wouldn't have been the only child in the pub either, I think, because, of course, this is a different time. You know, this is the 80s and sort of inner city places around by Shandon and Shandon Street. And when I came back to look at those memories, you know, at a distance of decades from New Zealand, they had a strange quality to them as well. They had a sort of a mysterious quality to them because I was like, did that really happen?
Yeah.
Like, did that actually go on? And of course it did.
Yeah. And look, there is a certain magic in those kind of places in the middle of the day and everything. But why a werewolf then?
Well, I think transformation is really important when you think about werewolves, isn't it? Mm. I mean, most of the time they're fine. But at certain times of the month, when the moon is doing certain things, then a person becomes a werewolf and then you've got to look out. So I think that idea of danger and ferocity as well, because I think, you know, and I'm speaking from my own experience here rather than my mother's, there is a certain ferocity that comes with drunkenness and with a certain type of drinking, you know, the change that comes with that and the personality shift that comes with that and the consequences of that, you know, the devastation.
And what were they?
For me?
Yeah.
Oh, man. God, where do I start? I mean, a lot of it was psychological, I think, Brendan. You know, a lot of it is just interior tension, you know. It was only, and I talk about this in the book, when I was getting panic attacks, you know, when I turned 30, I felt like the wheels were coming off, but I wasn't necessarily able to even admit it to myself or to talk about it very much. So a lot of it was internalized, and it was a real pressurized sort of thing, because I think if you're what they call high functioning and you're drinking, the pressure's on, you know, because you have to kind of try to hold these two things, which are actually, you know, they're not easy to keep going in tandem. And for me, you know, my story was that eventually I couldn't keep going.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't keep functioning and doing what I was doing and keep drinking.
Carol did keep a balance there, in the sense that, well, first, your father was quite tolerant of it all. He, like, almost enabling, and he'd drop her off and pick her up at the funeral home and stuff. She might be late, he might get annoyed, but he kind of accepted for her for who she was, did he?
Yeah, we'd call it enabling now, but I'm not sure that 30 years ago, you know, that was a concept that any of us would be aware of. So I like tolerant.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Also, like, one of the things I discovered in writing this book was the love story between my parents.
Yeah.
You know, I always had this idea, you know, I didn't even want to think about that, between my parents, you know, it's kind of cringy. But over time, you know, this ability that he had certainly to whole space, if you want to use another 21st century, you know, phrase, for her and for all of her complexities and all of her frustrations. Because, I mean, you know, I'm honest in the book about the amount she wound me up.
Yeah.
But for him to be able to do that, to build a family with her, and to also, I guess, you know, have a laugh with her, like, genuinely had a laugh and enjoyed. The first time I ever heard a man calling a woman Sybil, which was, you know, from Fawlty Towers, it was my dad and my mom, you know, that was his name for her.
Yeah.
So it was a darkly loving thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, he did. And he was very much a constant in my life as well. You know, again, I took it for granted until I grew up, as
of course,
we do.
Yeah, yeah. But she did look after you as well when you were kids, didn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and we were a big family, you know. But again, I was writing this book and thinking especially about our educations, you know, especially about the love that we had for reading and the love that we had for nature. And that didn't come out of nowhere. You know, that didn't come from a vacuum. And I had experiences when I came back to Cork, because the book is sort of begins towards the end of her life. I'm not giving away too much to say that. But I had conversations with people who would have known her as a younger woman and who were very close to her and who also saw her as a young mother and saw her sort of her parenting, you know, how she mothered us and what she showed us of the world. And that was a very humbling thing, you know, as an adult who thinks you know it all about your mother, to find out actually the effort that she made and the imagination she put into it. It forced me to reassess.
Yeah, and her ambition for you as well.
Yes.
Like, so you went to St. Angela's, which, for people who don't know, is a very poor school in Cork. But nobody from where you lived went to St. Angela's, did they? But she made that happen.
They were starting to. You know, it was starting to open up. There were girls from the north side of the city there when I was there, very proud, you know, North Siders. But certainly for her, it represented a big leap of ambition, you know, to walk up Patrick's Hill and to get those appointments with the headmistress at the time and to jump a waiting list, essentially, which was what she did.
Yeah.
And she was quietly proud, I think, about that, especially as a woman who didn't particularly enjoy conversation with anyone she didn't decide was worthy of it in the first place, to have to go and talk to strangers. But she did do that. And she didn't just do that for me. She did it for all of us.
Okay. And then it was kind of around your time in St. Angela's that you discovered that you were maybe a bit of a werewolf as well. Look, I think a lot of people drink dysfunctionally when they're young, but your drinking was kind of messy from the get-go, was it?
Yeah, that's right. I remember that first sip again, you know, to come back to that.
Do you remember that? Yeah.
I do, yeah. It was cider. It was Linden Village. And we got someone to buy it for us in the off-licence, you know, and everything was different in that moment. You know, I liken it sometimes as well. You know, the wardrobe in Narnia that you can sort of go through at the back.
Yeah.
And there you are in another world. You know, and it was like that for me from the very start. I remember that. And the only sadness of it was that it finished. you know, so then it's about the next time and the next time. And for me, I guess I could never judge where it was going to take me, you know, whether it was going to be just a great night or whether it was going to be a sort of cuts and bruises night. And I accepted that as just, I don't know, the price of doing business, I suppose, for a very long time,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Before thinking, oh, hang on a second, this might not be right.
And have you figured out, like, what's your theory on why you drank the way you did from the get-go?
God, I don't know. I mean, the short answer is because I'm an alcoholic, you know, and that's a question of self-identification. Not everyone would say that. Everyone would have other ideas. I think there's some very interesting science around the brain chemistry of it and how it affects you. But I guess for me, it's enough. I have a surprising lack of curiosity about it, I guess, because I've lived it and seen it and I know it. So I think for me, it's enough to say it's a physical, mental, spiritual change.
Okay.
That happens in an instant and that then, you know, takes me wherever.
And you were primed for that from before you ever took a drop, really, were you? And the first time you took a drop, it happened.
I feel like that in retrospect, yeah.
Mm. And, like, it was starting to cost you, even as a teenager, friends, relationships, that kind of thing. It was getting messy, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. And there's a tension, again, that comes with it. You know, there's just that tension because... You know, 9 nights out of 10 might be fine, but you don't know when the 10th night is coming. And, you know, I talk about this in the book, the night I had what is hopefully my last drink. It wasn't a bad night. I woke up the next day in my pajamas, you know, with the entire contents of my handbag and my mobile phone, which was, that was great going.
You didn't hate yourself.
Exactly. And yet, that was the end, you know, like that was the end for
me.
Why
did you know?
I just knew. I can't tell you how I knew. You know, I knew the same way I know my name or I know where I'm from. I sort of had enough, you know?
Yeah. Now, we're jumping ahead a bit. So you had gone to New Zealand in the meantime. So you were having a really successful life in New Zealand. You were a bit of a star and everything, but you were managing to keep up the other career as a drinker as well, yeah?
Well, you know, without wanting to be too disparaging, I think the media industry is an industry, Brendan, in which a lot can be allowed and forgiven so long as you can perform.
Yeah.
You know, so long as you can turn up and you can do your job.
And you were able to do that until you weren't, yeah?
That's right. Yeah.
So what were you doing there? You were a broadcaster.
I was a broadcaster, mostly radio. Mostly live radio. And it was a sort of vocation I fell into, really. There's a really healthy and vibrant and kind of amazing student radio network in New Zealand through which a lot of really cool broadcasters and musicians have come up through. And I was really lucky because when I went over to Auckland, I was waitressing in a restaurant in Ponsonby Road, which is a kind of a buzzy area of Auckland. And I knew a guy who I wanted to come back and do a master's in journalism because I'd been signed up for an MPhil in the history department at UCC, which obviously would set me up for a lifetime of employment. But I said, you know, I might give journalism a go. And I knew that for the MA, or the postgrad, you had to have some experience. And this guy said to me, you should go up to the radio station, you know, you should go up there and have a go. And I mean, you know what it's like, the sort of, it is an intoxicating experience. Live broadcasting, you know, it is a hit like no other. And for me doing that in the environment I found myself in the sort of, I think it was like the, you know, 2005, 2006, 2007, that era, it was incredibly exciting. And I was very lucky because New Zealand was really open, especially to, you know, to me, to outsiders, to people who were coming in. I think there was a degree of novelty value as well. But it was fun, you know, it was fun.
And that morning then, when you realised you had to stop, what did you do?
I just stopped.
Yeah?
Yeah.
On your own?
Yeah, I just stopped, you know, and I was still working. Like, a lot of stuff hadn't happened to me yet. You know, I hadn't lost a job. I hadn't crashed a car because I didn't have a driver's license. You know, I hadn't lost a lot of things, but sort of, I think, you know, the spiritual desolation that you feel, the loneliness, the sort of paranoia, the stress, that was telling on me. And I was very far away from home, you know, because Ireland was, is still home, and feeling increasingly isolated. You know, I didn't have family around me. I didn't have.
And the people who were around you, like, were had they started to kind of, you know, looks and saying things and stuff?
I think in retrospect, they probably had, but I wouldn't have made it easy. You know, it's very hard to talk to an addict in denial yeah. and tell them something they don't want to hear, you know, good luck. But I'd look back now and I can see that there were certain people who reached out and who were trying to kind of have a word with me. But, you know, I wasn't paying huge attention.
Yeah. And that first giving up was successful, yeah?
Yeah.
Was that it?
Yeah. Right. So far, fingers crossed.
Yeah, oh yeah, I beg your pardon, one day at a time and everything, yeah. So come here, I think it was then you started understanding Carl in a different way then, wasn't it? So there's a few contexts on Carl here that are interesting, right? First, there was her own mother. Tell me, so tell me about your mother's mother.
I didn't know an awful lot about her. And I guess I have to be sensitive as well, Brendan. Mm-hmm. You know, she's a beloved grandmother and a beloved mother of children who, you know, are still with us. So, you know, I'll just say what I know. And, you know, what I knew was that her relationship with my mother had been a fraught relationship and that it had been a difficult relationship. I knew there was love there, but I also knew that there was tension and there was antagonism and there was some hurt there. But really, you know, just to skip forward a little bit further, it was only when I had my daughter that we started to talk about some of those things in a bit more detail, in the funniest way possible, like in a very casual way,
yeah.
because, you know, I was sitting at home with a newborn. And my mother would ring me, you know, and it was kind of my morning, her evening, or her evening, my morning. I was in New Zealand and we'd talk for ages because I didn't have anywhere to be. You know, I was just sitting there with a newborn. And it was only in the course of those conversations where she just let slip a few things about her mother's experience of pregnancy with her, as she told the story, that I thought, what? You know, this sounds like an extremely stressful experience. You know, it sounds like her pregnancy was very hard. It sounds like she really suffered. And all my mother said to me was, you know, there was no help. There was no help for women then.
Yeah. And so your mother's mother was kind of, did not mother her when your mother was born, would be. So that primary, she didn't have that, you know, people talk about attachment. No,
yeah, yeah.
She never had that.
It yeah. sounds to me like she had postnatal depression and she yeah. had pretty severe postnatal depression, which again, I don't know if the language was there for it. I don't know if, it sounds like the help wasn't there for it.
Yeah.
But I was amazed by the lack of rancor with which my mother spoke about that. You know, she wasn't telling me this and she was kind of making conversation,
yeah.
you know, which was amazing. But
and just casually saying, like, she never held me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As a baby. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing then that I think you came to understand more about your mother, maybe after you became a mother yourself, was that she had two children before. You're the eldest in your family, kind of technically. She had two children before you. Tell me about that.
That's right. Yeah, I say in the book, you know, I'm the eldest of four or the middle of six, depending on which version of our family history you want. And I knew that, you know, we knew it growing up. We knew that my mother had two children before us. And I knew what a source of hurt and pain that was for her. You know, the first child was adopted and the second one died. And really, it was only after I had my daughter that again, I started thinking about, and not even just thinking about it, Brendan, but feeling it on a sort of a visceral level. You know, I'd come back to Ireland with a 10-week-old child because as soon as my daughter was born, even though I had that antagonism with my mother, I had to show her to her. You know, this was the pinnacle of achievement in my life as far as she was concerned. So I had to get over there and sort of show her the evidence. But, you know, I was coming down on the train from, we flew into Dublin and I was coming down on the train to Cork and I had this baby in in strapped the front of me, and you know, that physical weight. And I'd taken her, you know, on a plane for 27 hours or whatever from New Zealand, and I did the only thing I knew what to do, which was feed her the whole way. So I was sort of like a husk of a person by the time we got to Houston Station, and my husband was just, you know, throwing chocolate bars and sort of water into me. But it was just that physical feeling, you know, of being a sort of a breastfeeding mother with this child in front of me, and getting down to Kent Station where my mother was waiting, you know, in a like plethora of blow up balloons with, she'd pink hair, the balloons were purple, you know, the whole thing was all gold. She was ready.
Yeah, yeah.
She was the welcoming party for Eve, Alexandra, Hero, Daniel, my daughter. And to see her there, you know, like to see her there just like absolutely intent on welcoming her first granddaughter, and realizing, it was only a few months later when I started writing about it, I was realizing that journey to have her first child adopted would have taken her from Kent to Houston. You know, she would have done those train rides, first of all as a pregnant woman, and then as a pregnant woman coming back down to Cork with no baby. And that was just, you know, suddenly I understood something that I hadn't understood before about her. And I felt, you know, I felt floored by that. And, you know, because of the way things were at that point, it was very near the end of her life, you know. And I think that that felt to me like a universal experience we have as children when we suddenly find out something about our parents that has maybe taken us too long to realise.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking to Noel McCarthy and about her memoir, Grand, and it's about her relationship with her mother and with herself, I suppose. But it is an examination, I suppose, of that very visceral kind of archetypal relationship between a girl and a mother. You say something in the book as well, almost again casually, after the people in your mother's family saw what it did to her to give away the one of the babies, I think. Anyone else in the broader family who had a baby after that, they kept them.
That's what was told to me, yeah, and I loved that.
Yeah.
You know, I loved how that seemed to sum up the change that was coming. Because, you know, my mom, I was born in 1978, and my mother's earlier pregnancies were in the early 70s. You know, this was a time when Ireland was changing.
Yeah.
There, it was coming. There was a way forward, you know, for, you know, unmarried mothers, as we call them, to be able to sort of build a life and be able to be a parent. You know, that was happening. But, you know, one of the reasons I first started writing this story, I was at a writers' festival in New Zealand, and a woman who was speaking, a well-known broadcaster, her background is, she's from England. And she was talking about how her mother, who was from Nottingham maybe, or somewhere in the north of England, went into hospital to give birth to her with a borrowed wedding ring, you know, that she had just put on because she knew she needed to. And that stuck in my mind as well. I thought about that generation of women, you know, and how it would have been for them.
Yeah, and I think that's what becomes apparent very, as you go on in the book, is that it's not just a story about you and your grand and your mother and your grandmother. It's the story about what, I suppose, what was done to women really down the generations. Like, the other thing that becomes very clear about Carol, who was clearly this fantastically intelligent, spirited and everything woman, she was frustrated. Like, I mean, I'm not blaming the four kids, like, but she was frustrated.
He says, looking at me.
Yeah.
100%, absolutely. I mean, she was bored a lot of the time, I think. And I was very lucky in some ways and terribly unlucky to be her company. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, to be the person she talked to. Because she was, I mean, she was incredibly engaged in so many ways. And when I think about, like, how my taste has been formed now, a lot of it, you know, it came from her. She was the person who first sort of turned me on to so many of the things in my life that are really important to me now.
Yeah. But she came from a time in a society where she had to give up work basically once she had the first kid, yeah?
I don't think she definitely chose it, but I think she felt she had to. Yeah. You know, she was a psychiatric nurse, which was a real challenging field. And one of the things I found out after she died, just from talking to people again, was a lot of the work she'd done with, you know, young people with eating disorders, people who, you know, were struggling with really profound sort of mental health challenges, and how sort of patient and complex that work was that she did. And yeah, she gave it
and up. Look, it's not to denigrate parenthood in any way either. Like, I mean, that is hugely fulfilling for loads of people, men and women, like, but it just, it probably wasn't enough for her. And the other thing, you go back to that, the pub was her outlet. Neither probably was there, there wasn't a mother and baby group for her to go to, or any of those supports we try and give young mothers now, was there?
I mean, when I think about what was available to me, you know, I had my first child when I was 38 years old in New Zealand. And, you know, I was absolutely drowning in resources, you know. And some of the people that I thank in the acknowledgements of the book are the staff, the kayako, or the teachers, as we call them in New Zealand, of Eve's Early Learning Centre. I was able to send her into her early learning 5 days a week so I could write this book. Do you know what I mean? Like, the big difference between me and my mother is the availability of reasonably priced childcare.
Yeah. So then tell me about her illness and her death then. And I think particularly your goodbyes to her.
Yeah, I mean, I'm that generation that saw the funeral of a loved one on Zoom. You know, on a live feed from a church in a different place. And I think there's more of us now, of course, you know, because of the pandemic.
You had gone back, but Carl refused to die, essentially.
Yes. Characteristically refusing to adhere to anyone's schedule but her own. It's such a strange experience, a surreal experience, getting that phone call, you know, which I knew about it as a kind of an emigrant cliche. Do you know when you get the call? But to actually have a doctor say, you know, well, if I was you, I'd be getting on a plane right now. And I mean, I tried to be honest in the book about how I timed it, you know, because I thought I didn't necessarily need a last goodbye. You know, that was my thinking at the time. And I think I was very wrong about that. And the book sort of goes into that. But, you know, coming over at that time, I think the first cases had been reported out of Italy of COVID. I had left a very young child in New Zealand. My little girl was two. And I was just in this in-between space, you know, which is such a profoundly universal experience. I think your last guest was talking about how death is something that happens to us all, you know, like we can all bank on. But I, at the tender age of 42, I had no concept of my parents' mortality.
Yeah.
You know, I really didn't see that coming. And I was lucky enough not to have encountered sort of the death of anyone very close to me. So it was a very strange experience of being sort of pulled between two places and two states, like the state of being a mother and the state of being a daughter.
Yeah.
And not knowing which one to privilege. And in the end, you know, I had to go back because I had
But I feel you had a kind of a primal connective moment with her when you said goodbye that time, didn't you? Like, and it was visceral, like.
Yeah. Do you know, it was funny. Like, writing the book was one thing, but I read it for the audio book, and that was, I said to the engineer, you know, I'll do one take of this. I'll do one. And I got one out. But I haven't read it again since, you know, because I sort of, that's as true as I could make that moment when I wrote it. And I kind of don't want to go back to it, you know, because it's there.
Yeah. But I suppose it was a moment of the connection reestablished, the forgiveness, the everything. Like, you got the Holy Grail that everyone wants. You got closure, didn't you? Like, listen, we should say as well, it's a very funny book. And I think definitely, totally anyone from Cork, like, I mean, the textures of all our lives are in there, and the places.
Oh,
and everything.
Thank you for saying that. I was worried because they're a tough crowd, right?
Huh? Yeah.
I was worried about getting Cork right. So
no, I think so. And I think, look, I'm way older than you, but I still recognise the textures and the places and the kind of the various scenes and the types and the whole thing. Yeah. So the book is called Grand. Noel McCarthy, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brendan. It's been a pleasure.
Email brendan@rte.ie.